New Rock, New Roll by Richard Sparks. Sample chapter, read for you by the author. The narrator of New Rock, New Roll is a retired teacher living alone in his bungalow on the edge of a small town in England, where he spends most of his time online playing his favourite MMORPGs, multiplayer online role-playing games. In-game, his avatar is Dax, a heroic young battle mage. Well, why would he want to create an alter ego that looks like his dull old self? His teammates are Grell, the orc avatar of an Australian guy, and Krista, the twin-blade, sword-dancing avatar of an Asian-American girl. Together, they win the World Championship of Sword and Sorcery, as tens of millions of people around the globe watch live online. The next thing he knows, he's in the middle of a wilderness, in crappy beginner-level gear, armed only with a rusty sword and shield. And he's his own avatar, Dax, for real. And there's no sign of Grell or Krista. And wolves are howling and getting closer. It gets worse. He is captured by two wiry little woodskin archers and marched off to be sold at auction as an outlaw. He is conscripted into his lordship of Brigstow's army, along with Grell. They train up under the fearsome sergeant-at-arms Jack Blunt, known to one and all as Sergeant Bastard. They get good. But Dax is still just a soldier, not a battle mage with a magic staff. He doesn't even know if there is magic in this strange new world that neither of them have ever seen before. They still have no idea where Krista is, or if she is even there. Scrawny young street rat thief Olla is a fellow conscript, and the three of them help his lordship of Brigstow take his rival's town, Rushton. There, at the feast to celebrate their victory, they encounter his lordship of Rushton's daughter, Esmeralda, who had a blessing laid on her at her naming day by her mysterious godmother, a blessing that is also a burden, the loveliest life there ever was or ever will be. What follows are extracts from chapters 10 and 11. Being nobility, the high and mighty had observed the forms, though now technically my lord of Brigstow's prisoner in the great hall of what had, until a few hours previously, been his own castle. My lord of Rushton was at the high table, as if an honoured guest, seated on my lord of Brigstow's left. My lady of Rushton was on my lord of Brigstow's right. She looked composed and comfortable, her husband discomposed and sullen. But nobody looked much at them. All eyes were, at every opportunity, on Esmeralda, seated next to her mother. From our bench at the far end of the hall, she looked hardly more than a radiant golden blob. But she was the loveliest golden blob that any of us had ever seen. We drank her in and drank ourselves up, from loud to quiet to wistful and back again. Golden hair like sunlight on a waterfall, held back off her radiant, loveliest face by a bright green ribbon. A matching bright green ribbon graced her throat, a simple kirtle of the same green over a simple white chemise, eyes as blue as cornflowers and a smile that weakened knees. Her every movement was music. She chatted happily with all and sundry, and when she laughed, the great hall echoed with 100 answering, private, understanding murmurs of joy. Looking at her, we all felt like the only man there. Minstrels strolled below the high table, singing of chivalry, nobility, heroism and true love, but mainly getting in the way as they sang at Esmeralda, so we had to bend this way and that to do our gazing. It was an excellent night. The wine flowed and was magnificent. My lord of Rushton was something of a connoisseur, having some of the best vineyards in the realm down in his southern lands along the river. His stewards, eager to please their new overlord, made free with his cellars, bringing up the best stuff we'd ever tasted in our lives, and an endless supply of it. We enjoyed guzzling it, raising our glasses to him as he watched glumly from the high table. A day or two later. "Where in all hells have you three been?" Sergeant Bastard demanded as we were marched into the orderly room between six of his guards. "We've been searching high and low for you, castle and barracks. I even had to send a search squad into town." "That's where we were, Sergeant. Sorry, we were off duty, Sergeant." "We didn't know who wanted us, Sergeant. We had time off, so we blurted over each other and all at once, until Sergeant Bastard leapt to his feet, roaring, "Time off? Time off? There's no time off in my lord's army. What do you think this is, a bleeding school picnic?" "No, Sergeant. Sorry, Sergeant. What do you want to see us about, Sergeant?" we mumbled in reply, chastened. Blunt glared at us and slowly sat back down. "Well, you wasn't to know, I suppose. Came out of the blue to me, so..." He shook his head. How is you miserable lot to know that His Lordship of Rushton wants to see you right away, if you please, in His Lordship's inner sanctum? Off you go now, and look smart about it. It don't look good to keep His Lordship waiting, and it don't reflect well on me, so be off with you. At the double. 1-2, 1-2. We saluted, about turned, and ran. What's an inner sanctum? Grell asked as we hurried from the castle's barracks to its residential quarters. Dunno, I said, and neither did Olla. But Steward Hemworth did when we found him at his table in my lord's counting house. He worked all day and all night, did Steward Hemworth. Rumour was he even slept in the counting house. He led us along a dark panelled corridor with rich carpets on the floor, and portraits of haughty-looking Rushton ancestors on the walls sneering down at us. He knocked on the door at the end of it, and stood aside when my Lord of Rushton's harsh, supercilious voice from within rasped out, "Send them in!" "Yes, my lord," Hemworth said, with his usual obsequiousness. He held the door for us, and we stepped in nervously. A figure was seated in the chair beyond my Lord of Rushton's large, ornate desk. The chair was facing the other way. All we could see of it was its high, carved back. "Shut the door and leave, Hemworth," the voice growled, deep and rough. My Lord of Rushton clearly had a nasty throat that evening. I hoped I wouldn't catch what had brought it on. "And no listening at the door." "At once, my lord." "Certainly not, my lord." The door closed behind us. "Draw the curtains," my Lord of Rushton ordered. "Behind you." I turned and found the thick, heavy drapes which I drew across the door. Nosy buggers always listening at keyholes, hence the curtains. My Lord of Rushton's voice was somehow higher and less raspy than it had been as he rose from his chair and turned to face us, the reason for which was that the figure sitting on it was not my Lord of Rushton, but his daughter, Esmeralda. "Took you long enough," she snapped, and in her own voice it was the sweetest, most delightful snap you could ever possibly hear. Silly grins came to our faces, and we simpered. "Don't do that," Esmeralda ordered. "Do what?" I said, smiling dreamily. "Simper! I hate simpering! And wipe those stupid grins off your faces. You look like sheep that have eaten idiot grass." I laughed, as did Grell and Olla. "Is that a thing?" I said. "Idiot grass? Or did you just make it up? I hope it's a thing. I'd like to try some. It sounds delightful. If not, it's the cleverest joke I've ever heard." "Oh, for the love of Limnia!" Esmeralda groaned. She had come around the desk now and strode towards us. "Goddess of patience and forbearance, give me strength!" She stared at us, her lips pursed. She took a deep breath, clearly trying to control her temper. She began again. "You're here to do a job, a hard, horrible, dangerous job, which nobody must know about, ever, under any circumstances, and I picked you because you're hard, horrible, dangerous characters. Everyone knows what you did on the night of the raid. And you stand there simpering and tittering like half-drunk chickens?" "Tee-hee-hee," I agreed, thinking of chickens simpering, and Grell being compared to one, and how funny and charming she was, while Grell gurgled and Olla chuckled. She waited for us to stop. We eventually subsided and stood there, gazing at her adoringly. She stared back stonily. "Turn around," she said at last. We turned. "Okay, you can look now," she said, her voice slightly muffled. When we turned back, she was wearing a bag over her head. It was as if the light had gone out of the room and taken the unicorns and pixies and flowers with it, and the bunny rabbits had scuttled back into their little holes. "No," we said, "please take that off. There's no—" "Do you know how annoying," she interrupted us from within her bag, "it is to have to carry this stupid thing around with me everywhere, if I want to get anything actually done?" We did not. If we wanted to get anything done, we had to do it ourselves, but then we weren't nobility. "Inside this bag it's hot and stuffy, and I can't see your faces to see what you're thinking. It's much easier to lie to someone with a bag over their head than to someone who can read you like a wide-open book, so don't make me do this again." She took the bag off, and as she stuffed it back into the pocket of her smock, the sun came out again, the unicorns and rainbows danced around her once more, the bunny rabbits emerged from their little holes, and, "This is serious," she said. "I need you to take me seriously, for all the gods' sakes. At the moment, inside, I looked like him." She pointed at Grell, then held her arms up at him like claws above her head and gave a scary, attacking roar. It was the loveliest scary roar you could ever hear. "Oh," we murmured. "Ah," she howled. "I don't look like that," Grell said, grinning at her wistfully. "Wish I did." "Oh, so the big scary orc wants to be a girl, does he?" Esmeralda taunted. "No," Grell said quickly, "I meant—" He swallowed and finished lamely. "Nice." Esmeralda glared at him, breathing hard. Her glare faded, and she sighed. I'm sorry. It's not your fault. It's the fault of that fairy fucking godmother, excuse the technical terminology. What fairy godmother? I asked. I'll tell you later, if you agree to help me. Please? Her lips were trembling. I've got no one else to turn to. You're my only hope. Anything, I said. I shouldn't have spoken to you like that. Well, you're soldiers. I thought I had to act tough, or you wouldn't take me seriously. Tears were running down her cheeks. We were all handkerchiefs and concern, and there, and of course we'll help, and just tell us what you need us to do, while our hearts broke for her. She wiped her eyes with my handkerchief. She'd chosen my handkerchief, then blew her perfect nose with exquisite grace into it and handed it back. I put it away quickly, in a buttoned inside pocket, which even Ola wouldn't be able to pick. I wasn't going to wash that handkerchief ever. I was going to keep it always, have it framed and hung above my mirror where I could gaze at it. No, I'd wear it in my helmet as her favour, in a tourney, which I'd win because I had her favour, which meant that she loved me, and we'd get married and ride off to our castle, me on a white steed and her on a dappled palfrey with the unicorns and pixies and rainbows and bunny rabbits. Ooh, and some little Tweety birds too. I've never done anything like this before, Esmeralda said, breaking into my reverie. I'm scared, but I know I have to. And I don't trust anyone else in this town. They'll just shot me to Daddy, and I'll be grounded. And when I saw you at the feast, and heard what you'd done, and how brave you were, I thought Limnia had heard my prayers. I can't go alone, it wouldn't be safe. Go where? I asked. Mayport. Mayport, we knew, was the capital city, which lay many long leagues to the south. Them roads aren't safe at the best of times, Ola agreed. Bandits, outlaws, wolves, bears, and so on. And this ain't the best of times, what with the wars and such. And patrols, Esmeralda said. They'll be out looking for me as soon as they saw I was gone. I'll pay you, of course, 100 gold each. We wouldn't earn that much in 20 years in my Lord of Brigstow's army, no matter how high we rose through the ranks. Deserting sounded a lot more lucrative than soldiering. Grell said, why do you need to go to Mayport? To find her. Find who? My fairy godmother. None of us knew what to say to that. She came to me in a dream on my 16th birthday, and in all my dreams since. She's in the king's city, she says, and Mayport's where the king lives. I have to go to her, and I must hurry. I have something for her, she says, and she has something for me. I said, did she say what that is? Esmeralda shook her head. No, just that the fate of the realm depends on it. She sounded and looked miserable as she said it. Silence fell in his lordship's inner sanctum. I glanced at the others. Well, I'm in, Ola said. 100 a gold, or sitting on my arse in barracks all day? Too right, Grell said. Dull as hell a peacetime army. Esmeralda's slumped shoulders straightened, and she looked at us, almost in disbelief. You will? I said, we will. Oh, thank you, thank you, she hugged us each in turn. I'm sorry I was rude earlier. I just thought, well, you'd be hard, horrible, dangerous characters, so I had to be horrible. Grell, a soppy grin on his face from Esmeralda's hug, said, I'm not horrible. She looked at him. I expect you can be if you want. Well, Grell admitted, yes, but I'd never be horrible to you. Just to anyone I told you to be horrible to? Yeah, just point them out. But I don't want you to think of me as horrible, that's all, because I'm not, am I, Dax? Not to those you like, I said. See, I like you, he said to Esmeralda, and I'd like you to like me, which you won't if you think I'm horrible. Esmeralda thought and nodded. I see your point, Grell, but what I happen to want is people who can be, not are, horrible. Oh, I can be, he agreed, I'm just not, he grinned at her happily. She smiled back, a lovely, radiant smile, and it was as if the sun had suddenly come out in that darkened room. I promise I won't tell anyone, Grell. It'll be our little secret. Right, here's the plan. We followed her to her father's desk where she unrolled the map on it. It was large and detailed and showed the entire realm. We're here, she pointed at Rushton. Mayport lay way down on the south coast at the mouth of a long river, May River, much the largest river on the map. May River had its sources in a number of streams springing up in the western mountains, which all ran east in a long curve to the north of Rushton and Brigstow. It widened as they merged into each other, and then turned south more or less in a straight line, with the occasional long detour around hills, until it flowed into the sea at Mayport. "Think you can find your way there?" she asked. "Piece of cake," Ola said. "I'm good at finding." I studied the map. As I did, I traced the line of our journey so far. I could even work out vaguely where Grell and I had separately started. Pieces of the puzzle were beginning to fit together. Esmeralda tasks Dax with finding Pete the stable boy in the town stables to arrange horses for their flight. Pete, sad to say, is also a poet. He gives Dax his latest masterpiece, which he has written in honour of Esmeralda. Before dawn, the four of them sneak out from town and gallop for the hills, Esmeralda on her urgent quest to find her godmother, while her escorts, Dax, Grell and Olla, now deserters, would not like to be caught and hauled up before Sergeant Bastard. Eventually, they slow down and talk. It was Olla who remembered the poem. "Do you get a lot of poems?" he asked. "All the time," Esmeralda said glumly. "I've never made one up," he said. "I don't know how. Have you, Dax?" "Not really, no," I said. "How can you not really make up a poem?" Olla challenged. "You either do or you don't." "Well, I've done rhyming in my head sometimes," I said. "You know, you see a wall or something and think, that's tall. And then you go, look at that wall, isn't it tall? Compared with that, I am small. It's not profound or anything." "No," Olla agreed, "it's bollocks. But it does rhyme, for the most part. You, Grell?" "Yeah, orc poems. Slash, stab, thump, whack, hit me and I'll hit you back." "Also bollocks," Olla pronounced, and turned back to Esmeralda. "Is it any good?" Esmeralda grunted. "If it's anything like the last one," she muttered, meaning it'll be terrible. She felt about in the pocket inside her cloak for the piece of paper that Pete the stable boy had given her in the dark before that morning's dawn. She unfolded it, read it, and grunted again. "Well, go on then," Olla said. "Read it, out loud. I want to hear it." She said, "If I do, you'll want to cut your ears off." "I'll be the judge of that," Olla objected. "I like poems, me. I like it when the bards sing. Some of them make it up as they go along. Did you know that? You can ask them anything while they're in the middle of singing, and they'll drop that in and make it clever. We had a great bard in the Thieves' Guild back in Brigstow. You couldn't throw anything at him he couldn't handle. We all thought he should go off to Mayport and be famous. Have a great career, he would. Only, of course, being Thieves' Guild, he'd nicked it all from other bards, who'd beat the crap out of him if he used their stuff without the appropriate credit and royalty payments. You can sell stolen goods easy enough if you know the right fences. Apparently you can't sell stolen songs. There aren't any song fences. Go on, then," he urged Esmeralda. "Once is enough," she said, and handed the piece of paper to me. I took a deep breath and read aloud. "Thou shinest at my lord's high table, like the fairest maid in fable. I'd climb at night, if I were able, to get a good throw with my cable, so that it looped around thy gable, and tryst with thee in silk and sable, until the dawn, then down my cable, 'twere hanging still, around thy gable, back to my stall in my lord's stable. I'd love thee, though thy name were Mabel." I looked at my audience. Grell's face was closed, frowning. Olla's was open, mouth gaping, eyes wide, eyebrows raised. Esmeralda was scowling under her hood. "That's good, that is," Olla said approvingly. Esmeralda stared at him in disbelief. "It's drivel." Olla frowned. "No, it's not. All them rhymes. That's proper poetry, that is. Every line rhyming. Half the time they only rhyme every other line in ballads, and then different rhymes all the time. Not one rhyme like your poem. How many lines is it?" I counted. 10. Esmeralda said, "And they're all..." "Yeah, the same rhyme," Olla beamed. "That's exactly my point. Clever, that. I've hung from gables myself any number of times, but I'd never have thought of cable. I'd think rope, like I usually think when scaling roofs and such. And rope doesn't go with gable, does it? So, there you are. That's proper poet thinking, that is. And proper poetry words. So you can't say it's not proper poetry. It's got twer in it. Proper poems have twer all the time. I've heard them. And twas." Esmeralda's frown disappeared, to be replaced by the loveliest of smiles. "Oh, very good, Olla. You had me completely. I really thought you meant it for a moment." Olla was baffled. "I do." "It's proper poetry because it's got twer in it," she said. Olla stared at Esmeralda as if she was an idiot. "That's what I said." Esmeralda stared at Olla as if he was an idiot. One of them, I knew, was right, and it wasn't Olla. "And you meant it," she said. "And tryst," Olla said. "That's a proper poem word. And thee, and thy. He didn't call you like an oik. He used proper poetry words." Esmeralda was speechless. She looked at me helplessly. I shrugged. One of the best poems I've ever heard, in my humble opinion, Ola continued. What's it called? Esmeralda studied him. She was thinking, if this doesn't convince him, nothing will. She said to me, turn it over. I did. On the other side, words were written, in block capitals, decorated with little hearts and big X's. Its title, I said, with deliberate care, is For Esmeralda, Fairest of Maidens, with the Fairest of Names, but nothing rhymes with it. There was a silence as Ola puzzled it out. What, like orange? Doesn't rhyme with orange, Grell objected. Not with like, Ola elaborated. Nothing rhymes with orange. Or Esmeralda, he's saying. A bard told me that once. He said nothing rhymes with orange. Some lord who loves poems, proper poems, was offering 100 gold pieces to anyone who could find a rhyme for orange. The bard knew I was good at finding things. He wondered if I'd come across one. I hadn't. Nearest anyone had got to it, he said, was some troubadour who travelled everywhere, who said way up north beyond the uplands, the men wear wool skirts with crisscross patterns and have a bag hanging on the front of them called a spurringe. No one believed him. Might have done if he hadn't said that about the patterned skirts. I mean, it's cold enough down here in winter, never mind way up north beyond the uplands. What man would wear a skirt when it's bloody freezing, eh? And hang a bag on it? Esmeralda was staring at Ola open-mouthed. On her, with that perfect mouth and those blue eyes that you could drown in, it was an expression so utterly wondrous that you just wanted to stare back with your own mouth open, which Ola did. Esmeralda shut hers first and then turned to me. I hope you're in charge, not him. We're a democracy, I said. Well, who's in charge of it, whatever that is? We all decide together, I said. We talk it through and see what we all think. Esmeralda shook her perfect head in disbelief at such a ridiculous idea. Sunbeams danced in her golden hair, and sapphires glinted in her wide blue eyes, and unicorns and pixies and rainbows frolicked around her head. Oh, gods, she groaned. Unicorns and pixies, right? I nodded. And rainbows. Fuck, she muttered, and rode on ahead of me.